Welcome to the netzpolitik.org podcast. My name is Markus Beckedahl and my guest today is Seth Schön from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And Seth, you are here in Berlin for the Trusted Computing Conference. Trusted computing, does it mean an opportunity or a risk for a rising information society?
Well, I wrote an article a couple of years ago called Trusted Computing, Promise and Risk. And so I guess I was trying to suggest that both of those things are present. The most obvious thing is that trusted computing is pretty useful for some traditional information security goals. The famous example is that if you want to protect passwords and keys, even perhaps against someone who physically takes your laptop, that it's quite useful for that. In fact, at the conference, Peter Biddle from Microsoft discussed a new Microsoft product called BitLocker. Now, as I said, I'm not going to use it because I'm a free software fan, but it's a really useful thing as he described it. It's not any DRM-like kind of threat model. It's really traditional computer security. BitLocker is a full-volume disk encryption tool that uses trusted computing hardware. The consequence is that if someone steals your laptop, they can't read the hard drive, and they also can't brute force your passphrase because the software won't allow it, and the trusted computing chip is used to protect the software environment and cryptography that forbids the brute force operation. So the result is you can encrypt your hard drive, and someone takes your laptop, and there's probably pretty much nothing that they can do short of some sophisticated hardware attacks against the trusted computing environment itself. So that's really classic computer security. That's really a cool thing. I think we're going to see some equivalent tools in free software to protect SSH keys and GPG keys that might be on your laptop. You know, some people don't like to sign keys that are carried on a laptop because they say it's insecure. And so maybe if we get some hardware crypto in addition to the passphrase model, people will start feeling a little bit more comfortable with that. Now, the famous thing that's really qualitatively different about trusted computing and that's really of concern to people in the free software world and people who are concerned otherwise about DRM and about interoperability is this thing called remote attestation. Remote attestation is a part of the trusted computing technology that lets you prove what kind of software environment you're running. It's not any kind of active control. It doesn't say that you're forbidden to run something. It just says you can make a certificate that shows that currently you're running this. And that's something that we can't really do right now. So it's kind of a good thing and kind of a bad thing. The good thing is that you can tell people what software you're running. The bad thing is you can tell people what software you're running. It really all depends on the different motives and the different power relationships that are involved. If you're trying to tell your system administrator what software you're running, and you're afraid that you might have a rootkit on your machine, then it's really useful to be able to generate a certificate that shows, from the hardware's point of view, what software you're running, because then you can actually detect a rootkit. Conceptually, philosophically, there's no real way to detect a rootkit from software. The rootkit can always be cleverer than you are. If you're going to use a particular tool to interrogate the machine to find out if you have a rootkit, the rootkit can be cleverer and it can change the tool or change the tool's view of it. Peter Biddle, whom I mentioned earlier, has coined the term hypervirus. There's a term in academic computer science, hypervisor, which is a sort of a security kernel that has the ultimate privilege on the machine, and Peter says there's no reason that that couldn't be a virus or a rootkit that has that equivalent level of privilege and that controls the operating system's view of the world. In fact, in the Windows world and the Linux world, there's a real increase in the prevalence of kernel mode rootkits. Get system administrator level privilege, get kernel level privilege, and then you really can't trust anything. Even in the traditional sense of trust, you really can't trust anything that happens on the computer. So if you have a way for the hardware to help generate a certificate that really shows what's actually currently really running on your machine that you can then show to someone else. It's helpful if you and that person have security goals that are aligned or compatible. The example of a system administrator trying to help you tell whether you have a rootkit or not. And you can come up with a lot of other examples, and they're quite interesting because it's really a new thing. Of course, the disturbing situation is if you have a relatively asymmetric power relationship. Someone controls access to a resource that's relatively unique. Perhaps there are a lot of different users and only one such resource. One example could be an internet service provider. Another example could be a university that operates a university network. Another example could be a commercial entertainment company that's providing DRM-restricted entertainment works. In these situations where an organization has a lot more power than an individual, it starts to become, in a sense, a threat to be able to really prove what you're running, because it gives that other organization a new kind of power or leverage over your choice of software. If there's really no way for you to prove what you're running, then you could make a software choice that someone else disagrees with, and there's really no remedy. There's really no way that they can respond to it, because they don't know, and there's no way they can really find out. You know, the famous example, David Grorok from Intel mentioned this today. I told him, that's my example, why are you using it? But there used to be websites that said Internet Explorer only, and if they saw that you were using Mozilla, they wouldn't let you use the website. And so, of course, the response was program Mozilla to send a user agent string that says, I'm Internet Explorer. And people did that, and they were able to interoperate with those websites, because the websites really ultimately had no way to know whether you were using Internet Explorer or whether you were using Mozilla. They had to rely on what you said, and therefore they didn't have any source of leverage over you to really make you use Internet Explorer. Now, in the trusted computing environment, they can say, please give us a hardware-backed cryptographic certificate that shows what you're running. You could say, I won't give you such a certificate. You could say, I don't have hardware that can generate such a certificate. They can say, okay, come back when you have a computer that supports that. Come back when you've enabled it. You can choose not to give the certificate, but you can't forge it. Not in the industry's design. And therefore, for the first time, they seem to have a really reliable basis for knowing what you're running. And as I said, it's great if you and they agree about what you should be running. If you disagree, if you want to use some kind of software that some other entity thinks is not appropriate, or doesn't know about, or hasn't heard about, or you've changed it, you've modified the software environment, then you have a potential for shifting some of your power away from your choice and in favor of the other party. And I think that's a cause for concern. You can say, in the past, de facto, as a practical matter, people had some amount of choice over what software they used, even in a network environment, simply because there was no way to tell. And now that may change in some circumstances where some people have a lot of power because they actually potentially have a way to tell. And again, it's not in any absolute sense. It's not in any absolute sense taking away your choice of what you can run, because you can boot your computer from a CD and run any software that you want. It's a question of your choices of software in the course of interacting with someone else who has a resource that you need. Typically, that might be a cryptographic key. It might be a cryptographic key that unlocks a file that you have, or that decrypts a program that you have that you want to run. For example, someone could write an operating system and encrypt the operating system, and only provide the decryption key over the network if you can prove that you're not running the operating system under an emulator or a debugger. That's a typical example of where you might use this. Or only give you a decryption key for a movie if you can prove that you're really running a media player that they like. Or any number of other examples. And it's not necessarily malicious or pernicious, but it is a matter of changing, in some applications, the locus of control. A really strange application is a thing called Trusted Network Connect, which has been specified by the Trusted Computing Group. The idea of Trusted Network Connect is that when you get on a network, say an Ethernet network, the network, essentially the DHCP server, I mean, they have their various protocols and so on, but conceptually you can say the DHCP server asks you to prove what software environment you're running. If you say, I can't prove it, they say, sorry, only people who can prove it are allowed on this network. And then when you prove it, the network operator has a list of approved configurations. If your configuration is in that list, then you'll be allowed on the network. If your configuration isn't in that list, then you won't be allowed on the network. You might be redirected to a captive portal, like all of those Wi-Fi sites where you try to go to a website and it redirects you somewhere else and says, welcome to our Wi-Fi network. Please pay money or please click I agree or something. You might be redirected to a page that says, sorry, your software configuration is unrecognized. Here's some information about how to get an approved software configuration. Now, this is definitely being marketed only to businesses that have a traditional legal right to set a condition like that. It might not be a very clever idea for them to set such a condition, or it might be a good idea, but they have traditionally a legal right to do that. Of course, the technology doesn't know whether it's being used by a business or a university or a commercial ISP or a government. So we have a possibility, a very practical possibility, of having networks for internet access that can tell what software you're running and only give you internet access if you're running software that's approved by the network administrator. And that's something that we've never really been able to do before. So that's kind of strange. I think there's a risk, by no means a certainty, that that kind of access control will be applied outside the context of purely private networks, and also to commercial networks or educational networks, or imposed by governments. One way that could happen is in a place like the People's Republic of China, as a means of saying, well, we have a government-approved configuration, and no government-licensed ISP shall allow people to connect if they don't have that kind of configuration. I don't see that happening from the same motives in a Western country. But there's also this sort of public health analogy, public health idea, which is to say, in many Western countries, it's compulsory to receive a vaccination, an immunization against certain contagious diseases. We now hear claims like 80% of Windows machines on the internet are compromised as part of botnets or spam nets. So if people want to make an analogy to contagious disease, they could say, when these machines are compromised and used as part of botnets, it's as though they've contracted a contagious disease that's harming the rest of the internet, harming the general public. And by the same logic that requires people to get an immunization against measles or something, perhaps the computers should be required to get an immunization, like run antivirus software. Okay, how do you know if they're actually running the antivirus software? What if they have a virus and the virus says, yes, I'm running the antivirus software? I mean, this is a classic strange problem of the way that people think about computer security. You get email and it says at the bottom of the email, this email was scanned for viruses and it doesn't have one. Well, of course, someone can write a virus that prints at the bottom of every email. This email was scanned for viruses. So in the same way, if there were a rule requiring computers to run particular approved antivirus software, you can't, as a practical matter, just rely on the computers saying, purely in software, yes, I have an antivirus program. You would need an enforcement mechanism like Trusted Network Connect, where there's actually a tamper-resistant hardware process that's saying, I can prove that this computer is really running this environment. And I think conceptually, that's a way that some requirements for using something like that could appear or develop in some Western countries, purely on a sort of public health analogy, saying, Well, if we just allow anyone to connect any kind of insecure computer to the internet, it's going to get worse and worse on the internet for everybody else. And so, you know, before you can get on the internet, you've got to submit your cryptographic immunization certificate. Now, obviously, that's a real disadvantage for anyone who wants to use a software configuration that hasn't been somehow certified or analyzed. For example, if you use open source software and you like to modify it, well, there's no way, in an automated way, that an ISP can tell the difference between some strange virus that's never been seen before and a user modification that's an experimental or hobbyist modification to software. So that's a really very large conceptual problem, and it's a problem for almost any use of trusted computing in this way in a public environment. If you make a modification, your software is going to be different, the certificate that you generate is going to be different, and there isn't going to be any way that someone can evaluate whether your changes conform to a particular policy. So if they care, they're going to have to deny you by default interoperability. And so I think, to summarize, that's kind of the troubling new thing. As a purely practical matter, interoperability used to be mandatory in some sense. There was simply no way to enforce a policy that denies interoperability because we have a tradition of reverse engineering. In some jurisdictions, even a fair amount of legal protection for reverse engineering. So if someone creates some undocumented thing and someone else figures out how to make it interoperate, trusted computing with the remote attestation feature can serve as a technical basis for making interoperability optional. And that's something new. And again, it doesn't do that automatically. It's not like you have this chip in your computer and suddenly all interoperability disappears. It takes a lot of engineering effort and a lot of conscious effort and decision to break interoperability. I have a TPM chip in my ThinkPad. It's turned off. I never notice anything different. If there were an adequate installed base and adequate operating system support and someone went to the engineering effort, they have a basis for denying interoperability through technical means, but it's not going to happen by itself. And some of the trusted computing advocates say, well, instead of fighting against this chip, what you've got to do is watch how people use it and advocate against them if they use it badly.
So you are a digital rights advocate. What's your position or the position of the Electronic Frontier Foundation around the topic of trusted computing?
Well, I think we're very concerned about it. I wrote this article several years ago, and I came up with a thought experiment called owner override that a lot of people are now quite enthusiastic about. I think it has a number of practical problems and implementation problems. But basically, I said, I think they should either take out remote attestation or give the end user, at least the person who owns the computer, the ultimate authority to say whether the attestation values are accurate. And so if you're using attestation for an application that you agree with, like helping your system administrator tell if your computer's been compromised, then you can send a true reflection of what software is running on your computer. If you think that someone else is inappropriately trying to force you to use particular software, then I suggested, why shouldn't you have a way to say, yes, I'm using the software that you want me to, when you're actually not, when you're actually using some other rival software. Now, it's a long way from that to a practical implementation, and there are some applications of remote attestation that even people who hate DRM are somewhat sympathetic to. You can point to some distributed computing and grid computing applications along the lines of SETI at Home and the distributed.net projects. They have trouble with people cheating, specifically because they can't tell what software people are running on their computers. And a lot of people who really think that DRM is a bad problem for consumer rights are still sympathetic to distributed.net and to SETI at Home, and to the idea maybe of preventing people from cheating. You also have issues about network games. Even in the free software world, there's a famous example of a classic Unix game called NetTrek, and they have trouble with people cheating by modifying the client software. And they even tried to come up with technical means to let the server detect whether the client software was modified. This is many years ago that they came up with these means. They don't work very well because they're pure software. You can use a debugger and get the key and you can cheat. But it's interesting because there is some precedent for people even in the free software world to say maybe there is some application where it would be appropriate to be able to tell if people modified the software. So that's another sort of tricky consideration.
You are from the United States. We are here in Europe. We are thinking about regulation, about consumer rights and stuff like that. We are thinking about policy too. Have you ever thought about regulation of trusted computing to do regulation on the bad behaviors to protect consumer rights?
Well, I definitely do find that there's a bit of a cultural difference between the US and Europe with regard to regulation. The simplest thing would be to say that people in the US tend to be more against regulation. In fact, it was very strange at the Trusted Computing Conference that I attended. There were two government representatives on a panel, and we were talking about the issue of paternalism, that is, security measures that are for the benefit of a user, but that restrict the user. And you have certain analogies in terms of safety regulations. We were talking about airbags in cars and brake systems in cars, and maybe the manufacturer is expected to make it difficult for you to modify this, and it's intended for your safety. And you can make analogies to certain trusted computing applications where a user is not permitted to change software, and the result is a certain level of protection against a phishing or spyware, because the user is actually forbidden to install the thing or to override a certain security policy. And you know, I thought this is a very important topic, a very difficult topic conceptually, because, well, it's sort of for the user's benefit, and on the other hand, there's a cost in terms of innovation and the user's ability to experiment with things, which are very valuable, and we have this general purpose computer and programmability and flexibility. And there were two government representatives who essentially said, well, it seems that the general-purpose computer is obsolete and unsafe, and we've got to do away with it. And I slightly exaggerate what they said, but only slightly. And I just thought, in the United States, I don't think that we would have government representatives casually saying the end of the personal computer, and we need to have safety regulations for the personal computer because it's too dangerous. So coming around to the flip side to try to answer your question, we've never come up with a form of regulation of trusted computing that we were comfortable advocating. I understand that many people in Europe are very interested in that. I think it's difficult to do because it really is conceptually pretty hard to say exactly which are the good uses and which are the bad uses. And I think in software, you have this added complexity that every piece of software has many different features and many different properties and many different effects. And it's a little bit difficult to say this software is 100% bad or this software is 100% good. You could say, well, I'd rather change this part. But you know, computers are very stupid, and once they've been programmed, they're very inflexible. And so I haven't really thought about a practical kind of regulation that precisely divides the good from the bad. You can say we don't want to have remote attestation at all. I think that would be a reasonable position to try to defend, but then you can also say, well, it's kind of useful and you kind of want it sometimes, and you know, maybe there are some policies that are good to enforce. So I haven't come to a real resolution of that question. I actually think that any simple regulation is definitely subject to criticism and skepticism.
Okay, we will think about regulations in Europe and give you our hints. And yeah, we will later talk maybe at the CCC Congress again, or do you want to say anything last words?
I was also going to say, from the point of view of the free software community or the hacker community, the regulators also don't always make decisions that we agree with. For example, at the conference, a lot of the regulators were speaking very sympathetically about digital rights management. And so if you go to the regulators and say, well, we're concerned about trusted computing and we want a regulation that gets rid of the bad uses. If you say that digital rights management is a bad use, which in my opinion it is, the community of regulators at this point might not agree with you about that. They might say, okay, we want the regulation specifically to protect digital rights management as a good use. And I do definitely hope to be at the CCC conference in December. I've submitted a proposed talk about actually DRM in European digital television. So I'm looking forward to hopefully being there in December.
Yeah, we too. So thank you for the interview, and let's do another interview in December.